Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Healthcare Foundation, helping low-income Californians get the healthcare they need, on the web at chcf.org, and the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org.
For Tuesday, July 24th, 2018, this is Valley Edition, Valley Public Radio's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, we'll find out what proposed changes to the Endangered Species Act mean for the Valley and for threatened species like the Delta smelt. And we'll hear highlights from last week's Be Public Live community forum about the future of the arts in the Valley, and talk about a proposed new tax that would support arts organizations in Fresno. We begin, though, with a headline from last week that is still sending shockwaves throughout the political establishment of Kern County. Kern County District Attorney Lisa Green has filed criminal misdemeanor charges against County Supervisor Leticia Perez. The counts include using her governmental position to influence an issue in which she had a financial interest and for failing to file proper disclosure documents. Perez has pled not guilty. The DA's Public Integrity Unit alleges that when Perez voted last October against a ban on marijuana dispensaries, it was a conflict of interest. They allege Perez's husband, Fernando Jara, did business with marijuana companies through his communications firm before the vote. Perez was the only supervisor to vote against the ban. Perez has not addressed the media, but in a statement and press conference, her attorney, H.A. Sala, said his client denies the charges. He claims Perez is being subjected to disparate and discriminatory treatment. He pointed to a case involving a Bakersfield City Council member who allegedly violated the same statute, but who was not prosecuted by the DA's office. If convicted, Perez could face up to a year in jail and could be prevented from running for office for 4 years. D.A. Green says her office also investigated claims about corruption involving Supervisor Mike Maggard, but she says they found no evidence of wrongdoing there. So how unusual are these charges, and what do they mean for Kern County politics? Joining us now is Loyola Law School professor Jessica Levinson. Jessica, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So looking at this case, one of the things that raised a lot of eyebrows was the fact that this was not something that was originated from the Fair Political Practices Commission in Sacramento, but rather a county prosecutor. How unusual is that in a case of corruption against an elected official?
Well, the normal course is to see the FPPC looking at these issues first, or in the case of a locality that has an ethics commission, maybe the local ethics commission. I was just president of the Los Angeles Ethics Commission. And so for those charges that were particularly troublesome and did rise to the level of potential criminal conduct, we would work with the DA's office. But it is unusual, certainly, to see this kind of originated and no working in concert with the state's political watchdog, the FPPC.
How does the FPPC usually work? A lot of people who are probably going about their daily lives and maybe have some interest in public policy and politics, I imagine even them, they might not know of the intricacies of what goes on with that political watchdog group.
Yeah, absolutely. So the Fair Political Practices Commission is kind of like the statewide version of the Federal Election Commission. And they are the group. It's a group of commissioners. There are four part-time, one full-time chair, and they're charged with administering and enforcing our state's Political Reform Act. And the Political Reform Act is incredibly lengthy, but essentially what it boils down to is telling politicians and other elected officials and appointed officials what they can and can't do. So in this case, one of the things that the Political Reform Act talks about is conflicts of interest and when you have to disclose that I have a family member who has an interest in this issue, so I know I can vote on it, but I just want everybody to know this is what's happening. Or when you have to recuse yourself and say, for instance, my husband has a financial interest in this, I can't take part in this decision. And so when politicians potentially violate that, the normal course is for the Fair Political Practices Commission to step in and talk to them, potentially investigate, and potentially levy a fine.
This being a criminal charge, is that also significant in this case? It's not through the civil courts?
Well, if the district attorney's office is looking at it, it's going to be a criminal case. And so I think the fact that the district attorney's office, the public integrity unit, has decided to take it, has decided that there's enough here to file, shows that, you know, that they think this might rise to the level of criminal conduct. Again, in my experience, the majority of cases are basically disposed of with either the Fair Political Practices Commission or, in the case of some other cities and counties in California, like San Diego, Los Angeles, San Francisco, they're dealt with the local ethics commission.
And how do those cases usually wind up? Doesn't the FPPC also issue fines and things like that in some cases, or reach settlements with alleged violators in lieu of prosecution?
Absolutely. So when it comes to the FPPC or the local ethics commissions, that mostly the name of the game is a penalty, meaning a monetary fine. And sometimes there's some additional penalties, like preventing people from being able to run for office again. But again, the Fair Political Practices Commission, the local ethics commissions, those are all about monetary penalties and sometimes referring something up to the district attorney. When it gets to the district attorney, it's all about whether or not you will be charged with a crime and whether or not we will see jail time or some lesser punishment.
So how close of a relationship would there have to be financially for the spouse of an elected official? Is there gray area there, or is it a clear cut, this particular business could have benefited if that ban were not in place, therefore there's a conflict?
Yeah, well, I'm a little reticent to kind of give an absolute legal conclusion, given that I really only know about the case what I've read about it in the press. But I will say that what the Political Reform Act guards against is a direct financial stake, and that includes the financial stake of your spouse. So if you decide to vote on a project and it would benefit your spouse, that would be something that is impermissible. It would be seen as virtually the same as you undertaking a vote that would benefit you, because the idea is that spouses have joint income, share households, etc. And so to the extent that an elected official is voting no on something or yes on something because it would directly benefit their spouse's business, that would be impermissible. Now, the reason that I'm hedging a little bit is because it depends on that link of making sure how direct that financial stake is. And it also depends on some other factors that, again, are typically looked at by the FPPC.
I imagine there are other cases out there that people on different sides could point to. We were just talking about this in the newsroom the other day, and someone brought up a point. Well, in many cases, there are people with backgrounds in agriculture serving on local boards of supervisors, and in some cases, they voted on things that would benefit the agricultural industry. Is there a line between supporting an overall issue that might have an overall industry-wide benefit versus something that is more direct?
Maybe yes, there is. That. So, for instance, if you decide to vote on a proposal and it just generally benefits the banking industry, and you are involved in some way in the banking industry, then that is a less clear-cut line, for instance, than if you vote to help one particular bank obtain a favorable zoning ordinance, and you happen to be the part owner of that particular bank. Now, having said that, even if there's a vote that just helps an industry, period, and you are part of the industry, then in many cases, an elected official will at the very least disclose and say, here's my connection. If that relationship between the vote and the potential benefit is more direct, then in some cases they will have to recuse, even though it is an industry-wide benefit.
Now, on this particular issue, Supervisor Perez was the only vote against this ban. The other four supervisors were in favor of it. Does that matter in this case, that she was essentially her one vote didn't decide the issue?
Well, look, in the real world, that's something that would raise an eyebrow, meaning why is it that all of your colleagues thought one thing and you thought another thing? Was it because, and this is what the prosecutors will try and prove, was it because your husband had a financial interest? Having said that, I think that we should be careful not to tell elected officials that any time they're the lone dissenter, they could be subject to criminal prosecution. So is it something that people will look at and say, there's a reason that she was on her own on this. Yes, absolutely. Does it show, I mean, does it prove the case? No, it absolutely does not.
One final thing before we go. Her attorney, H.A. Sala, brought up this claim that she's not being treated equally, that a member of the Bakersfield City Council allegedly was involved with a similar issue, and that issue never made it to prosecution. But a reporter from another outlet brought this up at the press conference to D.A. Green, and she said, well, that case was never referred to our public integrity unit, so I don't have anything to do with it. What about that argument that this is disparate and discriminatory treatment?
So I know that there are some allegations here that this is disparate treatment, that this is in retaliation for comments dealing with the redistricting. I would say that, you know, I really don't know enough to say. I mean, I'm not there, and I don't know. If you look at the district attorney and the public integrity unit and who they've prosecuted, I don't have enough to draw a conclusion. I would say that I think that we should look at a really broad context before we decide to draw conclusions. So the fact that one politician is prosecuted and then we can point to one other politician that's not is not enough for me to say, oh, it's clear that there is or is not discriminatory conduct here.
It's a fascinating case, and I'm sure a lot more will come out in the weeks and months to come as this makes its way through the courts. Again, Loyola Law School professor Jessica Levinson, an expert on government ethics in California, joining us today talking about the case of Supervisor Leticia Perez in Kern County. Jessica, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Last week, the Trump administration proposed a set of major changes to the Endangered Species Act. It's a big issue here in California, where protected species in the Delta and Sierra have set off new efforts to protect critical habitat. Of course, those measures have also proven to be controversial in many areas. Just ask Valley farmers what they think of efforts to save the Delta smelt. So what does this mean for us here in the Valley? Michael Doyle, reporter with E&E News, joins us now to tell us more from Washington. Michael, welcome.
Glad to be with you.
So let's go through these proposed changes one by one. I understand one of them involves something we hear a lot from growers in the San Joaquin Valley who say the government should be taking into account the economic aspect of proposed protections for species. The Trump administration rolling that out much along those lines, are they not?
In part, under the Endangered Species Act, the Fish and Wildlife Service and NOAA Fisheries, which administer the act, are only allowed to take biological or scientific evidence into consideration in deciding whether to list a species. That's not going to change. What is going to change if the administration proposal comes through is that cost would be evaluated at the listing stage. Right now what happens is a species is listed, then critical habitat is designated, and at that point the costs are assessed. Under this proposal, the costs would be assessed and put out there for the public to consider at the time of the listing proposal. But according to the administration, the listing decision itself would remain strictly based on science.
I understand another change involves the sort of uniformity of the way that species are treated. How would that change under this new proposal? I guess everyone would be evaluated on its own. Is that a good way of describing it?
Well, in part, this gets to the concept of take. The Endangered Species Act prohibits the take of a species, which means to injure or kill or harass, degrade the habitat, and so on. The Endangered Species Act prohibits the take of endangered species. So that in California is like the giant kangaroo rat. There is a separate consideration for threatened species. In California, that's like the red-legged frog. Currently, threatened species get the same level of protection as endangered. It's a blanket protection. All take is prohibited. The administration proposes changing that so that a threatened species like the red-legged frog in the future would have a more particularly tailored protection schemes. So, for instance, ranchers might be allowed to degrade some habitat in exchange for protection elsewhere. So the administration says this is a way to separate the endangered from the threatened species so that one is more appropriately protected.
I understand that some people are also saying the new rules would essentially make it harder to list new protected species. Is that in this document?
Well, it doesn't have that phrase. Nowhere in the document will it say we're making this harder. I think there is a belief among critics, and certainly in the Valley there are a lot of farmer and developer critics of the ESA. There's a belief that there are too many species listed, that they are too easily listed, and that there should be some more consideration, stricter consideration to the listing decision itself. And I think that the cost issue that we discussed earlier is part of that. Even if cost is not formally part of the consideration, if the officials with the agencies are required to just enumerate the cost, they might be less inclined to list a species. So I think there is a perhaps hope among some critics of the law that these changes will impede the listing of species to some degree.
So you mentioned the persistent critics of the law, mainly here in the San Joaquin Valley, dealing with agriculture and development interests. We've seen congressional representatives, David Valadao, Devin Nunes, and others, highly critical of the government's actions to try to protect and preserve species in the Delta. Is there a sense right now of how this might play out with species like the Delta smelt or other things like that?
Well, it's a great and complicated question because, to some degree, these changes are only forward-looking. So, for instance, a species that's already listed like the Delta smelt, there is no immediate change that I'm aware of. There would be no immediate change to how it is protected. What would be affected are future species considerations. So if there's a California species that would be proposed for listing under the ESA, in the future, these changes would be taken into account. It's highly uncertain to me at this point, and these rules just came out in the last several days, but it's highly uncertain to me how it would affect the management and administration of the Act with regard to currently listed species.
Now, you've been covering these issues for a long time, both at your current job with E&E News, but before that as a McClatchy reporter covering capital issues. Put this in context for us. How significant of a change would this be if, in fact, it is implemented?
If implemented, it would be probably the most significant changes to the ESA in several decades. The law was passed in 1973. It's been years and years since it was reauthorized in any substantial way by Congress. You mentioned Congressman Valadao and Nunes and others from the Valley, and that includes the Democrat, Jim Costa, all of whom have sought for years to, as they put it, reform the law, make it more flexible, more understanding of corporate or business interests. And it's hard to get through. Indeed, it's impossible to get through Congress. So on the one hand, you have Congress that's stymied, and on the other hand, you have the administration, which in theory can take these steps on their own. Lawsuits will ensue one way or another. There's no doubt about that. The proposals that came out a few days ago and will now be subject to a public comment period are a long ways from being finalized or locked into place. But if, in terms of your question, if the rules as proposed come into place, it will be highly significant.
Well, let's talk about that a little more. Right now, these rules, would they fall under the executive authority, or is there some thought that this might need approval from the legislative branch in some sort of new law?
At this point, the proposals aired last week by the Fish and Wildlife Service and NOAA Fisheries are entirely administrative and in the purview of the executive branch, Fish and Wildlife and NOAA, which is part of the Department of Commerce. So unless there's some legal wrinkle that I'm unaware of, Congress need not play a role. And in a way that makes sense for the administration, which shares the Congress's or the conservative members of Congress's skepticism toward the ESA, but unlike Congress, they are not stymied by the filibuster rule in the Senate and resistance by Senate Democrats and environmentalists. The administration has much more authority to amend its rules and regulations without going to Congress. So in one way, these changes are a reflection of or a reaction to the deadlock in Congress that's lasted for years. Some of your listeners may recall Congressman Richard Pombo from the San Joaquin County area. He chaired the Resources Committee back in the 1990s and tried valiantly and futilely to change the law. So this is a longstanding battle.
You mentioned the battle there. What are the early returns from environmental groups and others on the opposite side of the administration on this proposal?
Well, at this point, everybody has fallen to their default position, which is to call the alarms and cast the proposals in the most dire or the most optimistic ways. And so environmental groups right now are loudly blasting these as raping the environment and so on. I think there'll be a chance for more nuanced debate and consideration over the public comment period, which is scheduled to last for about 60 days. And I think even some environmental critics of the ESA acknowledge that there is room for improvement and updating. But at this point, the early returns are loud and vociferous and black and white. It's either the great or it's terrible. But that will, as I say, perhaps become more modulated over the coming months.
Is there anything in this new proposal that came out from the administration that might have some potential to have some interest from folks on the other side?
That's the question I'm trying to answer right now, and I don't have my general presumptive answer is yes. There are some thoughtful conservation advocates that understand that there are valid points from all perspectives, and that they are now going through with a fine-tooth comb these proposals. Some ideas, like the consideration of cost, are complete non-starters in the way of in my reporting so far. There's absolute, it's anathema to take cost into account at all. On the other hand, this notion of getting rid of this current rule where endangered and threatened species are treated exactly the same, that has some appeal to some thoughtful conservationists. The notion of what's called unoccupied critical habitat not being part of a critical habitat designation has some appeal. So this is a case where the immediate response is, all hands on deck. But the coming months will be where the debate really becomes fascinating, which is where the details get ironed out.
Michael Doyle covers the Endangered Species Act and environmental issues for E&E News Online. He's been joining us today to talk about the major new changes proposed just last week by the Trump administration for the nation's Endangered Species Act. You can read his reporting online at eenews.net. Michael, thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. The group backing a proposed sales tax increase to fund parks improvements in the city of Fresno is celebrating a milestone. The group Fresno for Parks claims that last week, their members delivered just under 35,000 signatures to the city clerk's office with hopes to qualify for the November ballot. If it makes it to voters and they approve, the measure would raise the city's sales tax 0.3 cents to fund parks. City clerk's office says to qualify, backers need a little over 23,000 signatures to be valid. There's been a lot of attention in the media on what this measure would do for parks, which are lacking in number, amenities, and even basic maintenance in the city of Fresno. But while 46% of the proposed tax revenue would go to maintenance and 21% for new parks facilities and 11% for trails, there's another category that's largely gone overlooked, the arts. Under the proposal, which backers say would generate $35 million a year, 12%, or roughly $4.5 million, would go to expanded access to arts and culture via new grants. Last week, here at Valley Public Radio, we held a public forum about the future of arts and arts organizations in the Valley. While we touched on a lot of issues about changing audiences and new ways for organizations to be innovative in their programming, a lot of the discussion centered on the issue of the parks and arts tax. Stephen Wilson of the Fresno Philharmonic was generally enthused about the prospects.
Fresno Philharmonic is strongly in supportive of it, quite beyond what the measure would do for our organization. I think it would be a huge boost to the whole arts community. Should the measure be passed, it would be a really significant inflow of funds to the arts community, which I think would be a boon to, you know, all of Fresno's arts organizations. I think it would provide stability to, you know, to larger organizations. It would also provide, you know, money to grow new organizations. I think it would be, you know, it would have a lot of tremendous benefits. You know, most professional symphony orchestras in the U.S. get some money from either their city or county government. That's kind of a reality. It's usually not necessarily a huge percentage of the budget, but it is part of the mix of funding that most communities that have been able to support symphonies, museums, opera companies, whatever, that local public funding is part of it, and Fresno has not had that. So, I think it definitely would be a potential game changer for the arts community here.
Frank Delgado, chief curator and executive director of Arte Americas, also was supportive of the project.
Yeah, Arte was a big supporter for all of our a lot of our events that we had in the final days of the acquiring signatures. We had multiple people out at the events and a lot of support. And just echoing everything that Stephen said, it would just be great all around. It's great for the arts organizations. It's great that there is support from people who see the need for something like this, and not only for the organizations, but just in really recognizing the importance of aesthetic and experience. And there are all these, parks that have been, sort of in disrepair. And so I think in bringing those back to where they need to be, and there's certain areas that have been neglected. So to be able to bring those back, I think there is a value in that a lot of people who aren't such, fervent supporters of this, that they don't really realize that. And then also just including the arts in that as that sort of necessary component to also, this way you have indoor and outdoor sort of beautiful aesthetic. And I think it's wonderful. I think it's something that we should be proud of, that, Lilia Chavez, Fresno Arts Council, did so much work to get this thing, pushing along. And, and I saw the photos of them taking all these boxes of signatures. And I think that Fresnans need to be proud of themselves that this, has gotten this far.
But with public funding can also come a higher level of scrutiny, and that's something that was not lost on our panel. Nicolette Anderson of the Selma Arts Center, which is funded in part through a hotel tax or transit occupancy tax, says that's something she deals with on a regular basis.
Actually, we have a TOT tax, which goes directly to recreation, and a percentage of that goes to the arts. So we currently are dealing with something like that involves the city and politics. And at any moment, we could lose that funding. And that funding right now currently goes straight into our youth theater. We have a youth performing arts, and that's funding our staffing. It's funding our teachers. And at any moment, that could go away. And that also helps our building as well. And so, yes, there is that moment where we could anger some of our city officials. We could do a show or an art show that's maybe a little... Yes, exactly. A little risque that maybe one of our council members didn't enjoy, and then it could be up for debate. And we are always at that risk, but we really try not to let that hinder us. So and we really try to be self-sustaining and not count so much on that funding so that we are able to still do art.
But Stephen Wilson of the Philharmonic told our audience at Valley Public Radio that he's not too concerned about that issue.
I think the way the measure, as constructed, definitely has some buffers between City Hall and the grants. There's a whole process of, that it would start The measure, if adopted, would start the process of the development of an arts master plan, and there would be another entity that would be involved in actually doing the grant making, and so forth. So I think it's not so much that, you know, the mayor or city council person would be making a decision on a direct decision on the arts funding. So I think the appropriate buffers are there, as they are in systems like the California Arts Council or the NEA.
Of course, if voters approve a tax this go around, it wouldn't be the first time that arts organizations got funding from voters. In March of 1993, 57.4% of Fresno's electorate voted in favor of a sales tax of 0.1%. It was called Arts to Zoo and was going to fund everything from the Fresno Metropolitan Museum to the Philharmonic and the Fresno Chaffee Zoo. A court later overturned that tax, saying it was a violation of California's Proposition 62. After that defeat, backers of the zoo went on to pass their own sales tax measure, but one that left out the arts. And there are already opponents to this new tax, including Tal Cloud of the Lincoln Club of Fresno, speaking here a few weeks ago to our Laura Tsui.
I think there's too many taxes already in California, specifically in Fresno. We have a zoo tax, we have a highway tax, we haven't, you know, we pay gas taxes and sales tax and property taxes. We don't need a parks tax. This is for a small group of people that want to benefit themselves. Tree Fresno is behind this. Tree Fresno wants to do this so they can get, you know, more support for their organization. Central Valley Community Foundation is given, you know, money for the poll because they want, again, these groups are all about self-fulfilling for their own their own use, I guess. And we don't need another parks tax. There's when we're building houses, the developers are paying to build parks. And if people, you know, the parks we already have, they may be filled on Easter weekend, but they're not going to be filled on a Wednesday afternoon. And so we have plenty of parks. And if people want to build parks, I think the developers need to be building parks within their communities, but that's their choice as well.
And he says, what about those people who don't go to parks or don't want to go to arts organizations?
So we're talking about, this is a specific tax that we're paying $365 versus a tax that we're paying when we choose to use it. If I choose not to go to a park, I can't not choose to pay for the park. And this is an additional tax that I'm going to have to pay for whether I use the parks, live in the city of Fresno or not.
Okay.
So I'm not necessarily benefiting from this tax. Whereas if I choose to go to Yosemite and I have to pay $25, it's my choice to spend the $25, so I think it's different.
It's still far from a sure thing if the tax, as currently proposed, will go before voters in November. First, there's the matter of qualifying with enough valid signatures. And then there's the issue of politics. Will the Fresno for Parks group, which is led in part by former Fresno Mayor Ashley Swearingen, strike a deal with current Fresno Mayor Lee Brand? Brand, after all, proposed his own sales tax measure earlier this year, which would have funded police and parks, only to pull it when he realized he didn't have support from the city council. Could the two sides strike a deal? And will the arts be left holding the bag? And regardless of what happens, we'll be reporting on it here at Valley Public Radio. You've been listening to Valley Edition and highlights from our Be Public Live forum last week. And stay with us here on FM 89. We'll be back with more of Valley Edition and talk with surfer Bethany Hamilton, who is in the Valley, returning to the surfing ranks at the Surf Ranch in Lemoore. That and information about new developments in the shutdown of a medical clinic in Merced County that left many stranded. That's coming up on Valley Edition.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. People are looking for all kinds of ways to kick drug habits, and some are turning to online communities. We'll meet a former drug addict on his home turf.
That's where I went to school, actually. That's where I first used opiates, right in that building there. First time I ever nodded out. It was next to my current girlfriend in English class.
That's next time on Here and Now.
Here and Now starts this morning at 11 on Valley Public Radio.
What are you doing Tuesday night, July 31st? If you're free, Valley Public Radio invites you to dinner at the Vineyard Restaurant in Madera. It's part of our 40th anniversary celebration. The Vineyard Restaurant features a rich variety of locally sourced food and wine, and it's easy to find just off Highway 99. enjoy a delicious full-course dinner, including dessert, only $50 per person, tax and tip included, and half of proceeds benefit Valley Public Radio. Tickets are available right now at kvpr.org.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. There are new developments this week in the ongoing case of fraud, mismanagement, and corruption, all allegations leveled against the management of a former medical clinic, a network of clinics in the North Valley, Stanislaus, Merced, and Madera counties. That's where Horizons Unlimited made its home. And here to tell us more is a reporter who's been following the story for some time, our own Monica Velez. Monica, welcome.
Thanks.
Monica, you've been following the story for some time now, both here at VPR and also in your former job at the Merced Sun Star. Before we get into the allegations and this new plea agreement that was reached in federal court between the former CEO of this company, what was Horizons all about? What did they do for people before we find out what they did allegedly wrong?
Yeah, so Horizons Unlimited, it was a clinic founded in 2004. It served mainly low-income people throughout the Northern Valley. And they had 8 clinics. It spanned across Merced, Stanislaus, Madera, and Mariposa counties.
And then a few years ago, things started to go wrong. The clinic closed down, what was it, last year? And this was a pretty big deal.
Yeah, all the clinics shut down on August 1st of last year. And that was after a bankruptcy filing. It was after some lawsuits between the CEO, Sandra Haar, who founded the clinics, and, you know, some different board members.
So what do officials allege Sandra Haar did to initiate this criminal prosecution, which now has resulted in a plea agreement? What are the overall grounds for these corruption and fraud charges that are out there?
Yeah, so Sandra Haar, she's being charged with 2 counts right now. One is healthcare fraud, and the other count is a conspiracy to receive kickbacks. And so she's pretty much admitting to falsifying documents to Medi-Cal and Medicare with the intention of profiting. So in the proposed plea deal, it says that she knowingly billed Medi-Cal and Medicare for services they wouldn't have covered otherwise.
And I understand in some cases, people who would go to a physician at a Horizons clinic were kind of managed in a way to for greatest profit at the expense of taxpayers. Tell me about how those clinic visits would go sometimes.
Yeah, so I had talked to some people in Merced County, some former patients of Horizons, and, you know, multiple people have told me that, you know, they were maybe going in, for example, one woman, her daughters had to go in to get braces, and it took them, like, 3 or 4 different visits to complete the whole thing, something they could have done in one visit. And that kind of aligned with what the plea agreement said, where Sandra Haar, she would tell her employees to make it so patients had to come in multiple times unnecessarily, they found, in order to be able to bill Medi-Cal more often.
Very interesting. And that's one of the issues at hand. And then the other deals with these kickbacks. A lot of different companies involved here, some of them controlled by the Haars, some external. What's the deal behind the kickback as part of this plea agreement?
Yeah, so Haar's also admitting to receiving kickbacks. It was from an executive at a medical laboratory testing company. They were named Latara Enterprise Foundation Laboratory. So in the plea, it says that Haar received $1,000 a month from the lab in exchange for referring her Medi-Cal and Medicare patients to this lab. And their arrangement was kept confidential. And they said that these kickbacks were for a donation for a church. But in reality, Haar was actually pocketing this money. It never went to a church. And the documents say that she made more than $2 million during this arrangement.
So how did this first start to go bad for the Haars? Where did the cracks in the facade first start to appear? Because you were on the ground reporting on this back in your days for newspapers in Merced.
Yeah, so the legal battles, everything first surfaced in March of 2017, and that's when Horizons actually filed a lawsuit against Sandra Haar in the Merced County Superior Court. And in this lawsuit, Sandra Haar, she was accused of misusing clinic funds so that her and her family could profit. During that time, she was also fired. And after that first lawsuit, that's when everything kind of started to crumble down, it seems. You know, the clinic filed for bankruptcy in May of 2017. And then on August 1st,
of 2017, all of the clinics shut down.
So what does HAAR have to say about all of this? I understand at one point you did talk to her a while ago. Has she said anything about this most recent development?
Yeah, so when I talked to her a while ago for one of the stories I wrote at the Sun Star, HAAR denied any wrongdoing. She said that the clinics weren't in debt when she left. She said there was no wrongdoing on her part, that if there was any type of falsifying of documents, she had no idea of that. I reached out to her recently to see if she wanted to comment on this, and she actually declined to comment.
So where does this go from here? I understand while this may bring the criminal proceedings to a close, there's also at the other side of the Eastern District Court in Fresno, in the bankruptcy court, there's also a case that's ongoing there.
Yeah, so in the bankruptcy court, the court-appointed trustee, he motioned for a compromise with the HAAR family. That includes Sandra HAAR, her husband Norman HAAR, two of her daughters, Katie HAAR, Sarah Price, and Sarah Price's husband, Kevin Price. And so the court has agreed to the trustee's motion, which is to settle the claims against the HAARs for $2.4 million. And the way that they're going to pay that settlement is the HAARs have agreed to let the trustee sell their properties until that amount is met.
So tell me, how did this affect people on the ground in Merced, the people you've talked to there who had been relying on these services?
Yeah, so this affected thousands of people in the Valley. You know, all of these clinics suddenly closed, and a lot of people that I talked to, they had nowhere to go. I talked to one person, and she said that her husband, you know, he had already paid for a root canal. He was trying to get it fixed, and then all of a sudden these clinics closed, so he didn't really know what to do. There was a lot of people had trouble getting their medical records early on, and so he had difficulties with that because, you know, no other specialist wanted to kind of treat him unless they had his prior records. So a lot of people's lives were kind of put on hold when it comes to that. And it wasn't only the patients that were affected. There, a lot of the clinics around Merced, they just had an influx of people come in because it's already challenging enough for many people, especially in Merced County, to, you know, get appointments or even find a regular doctor. So it affected anybody from patients to physicians to clinic administrators. And it also affected a lot of the employees who worked at Horizons. You know, some didn't get paid the money that they were owed. And, you know, a lot of them suddenly didn't have a job anymore.
Well, we'll see where it winds up. It looks like the case is nearing a close as the former CEO of Horizons Unlimited, Sandra HAAR, has accepted a plea agreement in U.S. federal court involving fraud and kickbacks with the Horizons medical clinics in Merced, Madera, and Stanislaus County that closed last year. Our own Monica Velez has been covering that story and leading the coverage on that for some time. Monica, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to Valley Edition. We reported back in May about the new state-of-the-art surf ranch in Lemoore, which has brought world-class surfers to the area. One such athlete came to the wave pool last week to announce her return to competition after having her second child earlier this year. Pro surfer Bethany Hamilton is well known for surviving a shark attack at age 13, which she wrote about in her book Soul Surfer. She'll be competing at the surf ranch this September. But before taking practice runs in the wave pool, Hamilton talked with Valley Public Radio's Laura Tsutsui about surfing, being a mom, and how she doesn't worry about sharks, just about catching waves.
So I'm here at the Surf Ranch, and I came up here to train. I'll be competing in the Surf Ranch Pro this September, and so I'm just so excited to have the opportunity to compete and at the highest professional level. And so I'll be here training and working at just getting prepared for that event.
What is it like to be mom, athlete, you know, and if that's not enough, mom, athlete, amputee, motivational speaker? How do you balance all of that?
I feel like it's always a balancing act, to, especially in my role of doing so many different things and surfing and mom and wife and speaking and just all the different things I get to do. And I feel really thankful for all this because, you know, with my work, I am still able to be with my kids a lot, like all the time. And that is the most important thing to me. And yeah, I think I'm just always kind of like, I've become a big planner. So I'm always planning ahead and making sure that I use my time wisely and try to be very present and not get carried away on my phone, which has all my work on it. And yeah, just be aware of like how I'm using my time.
And then I know you also just had your second child. Congrats. So how do you compare wrangling like two kids to one?
Oh my gosh. I had a couple moms totally prepare me with a warning that two kids is a lot harder than one. It just feels like a really big adjustment. And they were so right. It totally did. And like, especially the first 3 months when baby's so little and you're just keeping them alive and they're just little blobs, but it's so like such a precious time too. Thankfully, my husband's super supportive and able to like kind of teamwork everything with me, and it, yeah, it's so amazing.
What are your kids' names?
My older son is Tobias and younger is Wesley, and yeah, they're such beautiful, handsome boys.
What are your kids? Do you expect them to be surfers as well?
Oh, I really hope they get into surfing at least for fun so I can like share that with them. And like, I really envision like going on like family surf trips and like being able to travel the world together as they get older. I mean, my older son Tobias is almost 3.5 and he loves surfing. He loves being in the water. And so I'm just trying to keep it really fun and not have too many bad wipeouts that scare him off of it. And so far, he's just stoked on being in the water.
Being a mom and an amputee, how do you manage that?
Oh my gosh, I definitely like went into motherhood a little. Like I had some natural fears that kind of like, a lot of what I was scared of like didn't really actually end up turning out to be true. So
like what?
Like, you know, when you get a newborn, their head's all wobbly and being able to hold them good and keep them like their head from like getting whiplash or whatever. And yeah, I just adapted so well naturally. And nursing, like I'm breastfed all my kids, and just being able to figure that out with one arm, like doing on my left side. And I think often we're more resilient than we know. And that definitely turned out to be the case.
So what's it like to jump back into training and, you know, potentially competitive surfing come this September? What are you, you know, but with two kids also, what is that like?
Oh my gosh, yeah. I mean, there's definitely some times, like, I started my postpartum training after, like, easing into it around 9 weeks, and your abs are just completely gone. There's no more strength there, and it feels pretty daunting. It's like, but at least with it being my second, I kind of knew what to expect and, like, give myself some grace and time to, like, get back to it, and now my little guy's 4 months old, so I have a couple more months before the event, so I'm looking forward to keep working at that, especially once I get home, and especially the next couple days here surfing and just doing my thing.
And then, I mean, coming this September when you do compete, what are you expecting to be maybe the most challenging?
I really think the mental aspect of competing here this September will be the most challenging, because I just, it's a different style of competition. You know exactly what you're getting. There's not so many variables like the ocean can bring. So here, just being able to be strong mentally and not like overthink it at the same time, and just being ready to just put a show on in front of everyone. So I'm really excited to have the opportunity to be competing here against all the best. And I know it's going to be really hard. So yeah, I'm just trying to keep mentally like positive and look forward to just doing my best.
And then, I mean, obviously you compete with the best of the best. But is it, I'm wondering if it's ever like tiring for people to just feel like they know you from Soul Surfer and not necessarily always because you're an amazing surfer.
Yeah.
I mean, it goes hand in hand, but you know.
Oh, no, you nailed it. Like, definitely a lot of times people, like, they'll be so excited about me, but it's almost like they're more excited about Soul Surfer. But, you know, I feel really thankful that I'm in the role that I am, and like, I'm able to inspire young girls to go and overcome their challenges in their life, and they're like, the tough times that they go through. And I know that, like, to me, just being able to be a reminder of that hope that you can overcome really tough circumstances is really special. definitely like being in the public eye is something I don't thrive on, and I never have, especially as a young girl. And it's always like a balancing act mentally to like be ready to just be kind of on to say hi to someone all the time when I'm out in public. But I also know that like I want to do my best as I can, and you know, I'm not perfect, but I just try to remember that like, man, this is someone else's kid, and if it was my own kid, like I would want to just stoke them out. So yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and one of the things I'm wondering, being that you took a break while being pregnant and now you're coming back, it's kind of like a fresh start. Is, as people sort of start to see you again as a competitor, reevaluate you, is there anything that you would want them to know or to think about, like, as they start to be like, oh, Bethany Hamilton's competitor?
Yeah, like, as a competitor, you know, I really celebrate my body. For example, I'm almost 6 feet tall, which always surprises people when they meet me in person. And I have a lot of natural strength. And when I work at it and make myself even stronger, then I come off as really strong surfer. And I think that's really special as a female. And so I really am excited about competing. And apparently the lifeguard said I got one of the longest barrels on the left by anyone. So I think I have definitely a stabbing shot at doing really well here. And I've always grown up really competitive, and I still have that drive. And I think taking a four or five month break from surfing, it makes you so hungry and excited about surfing that like as I'm getting back into surfing right now, I just have like this like spunk to my surfing that I'm just so pumped to be out there and like push myself even further and get better and better.
I think the last thing that I want to ask is, in a documentary, you had said something like, it just felt sharky that day. What does that even mean?
You know, it's funny because I think all surfers kind of, you know, at the back of their head, they're like, oh, sharks, like, I don't want that to happen. But there's certain days when it just feels different. Like, you know, if the water is a little murkier, it's like, feels sharky. Even though it might not even be sharky, but I'm really thankful that I've been able to heal from that. And like, I don't really feel like I'm particularly more paranoid than the average surfer, which is really awesome. I go out and surf and just think about catching my next wave.
Totally. That's that one I wanted to say, like, have you ever felt like scared after that or, you know, nervous?
Yeah. I mean, I definitely had to overcome my fear, and it took time, and I found that just like focusing on catching waves was like the best thing. So at least at the Surf Ranch, you're not worrying about sharks at all.
That was pro surfer Bethany Hamilton talking the other day with FM89 reporter Laura Tsutsui about returning to competitive surfing this September. They spoke in Lemoore at the World Surf League Surf Ranch. And that does it for Valley Edition. As always, you can visit our website, kvpr.org, to subscribe to our podcast, find our audio archives, find us on social media, and much more. Again, all of that's at kvpr.org. And remember to download our mobile app for iOS and Android phones and tablets, available at Google Play and the Apple App Store. The search KVPR. For Valley Edition producer and reporter Laura Tsutsui, reporters Carrie Klein, Monica Velez, Mark Benjamin, and Christina Lopez, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Healthcare Foundation, helping low-income Californians get the healthcare they need, on the web at chcf.org, and the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org.